Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church, the show where we harvest the fruits of the last week of journalism on the Vatican beat, trying to glean those precious few pieces of sweet fruit that we can put before you to provide an appetizing journalistic meal. Here's what we've got for you this week. We begin with General Hospital. For the first time in 2024, though hardly the first time in his papacy, Pope Francis visited Rome's Gemelli Hospital this past week amid an ongoing bout of bronchitis. We'll bring you the latest and greatest on the papal health front. Second, we've got Double Demos. Once again, an unnamed cardinal writing under the pseudonym of Demos has produced a stinging indictment of the Francis papacy and a kind of to-do list for the conclave that will elect his successor. We'll explain what to make of it all. Third, the trouble with travel. Why, one item on the prognostications of Demos about what the next pope ought to do is almost certainly dead on arrival. We'll explain what it is and why it probably isn't going anywhere. Fourth, jousting over gender. Once again this past week, Pope Francis took a swipe at so-called gender theory. We'll explain why this is perhaps the classic instance of a recurrent storyline in the Francis papacy that just doesn't jibe with the larger narrative about this pope, and therefore probably doesn't get the attention it merits. And finally, this week, we've got sizing up secularism, how some news developments out of India are a reminder that what Catholics make of secularism often has a great deal to do with which neighborhood they live in. All that and more is waiting for you on this edition of Last Week in the Church, so please don't go anywhere, because I will be right back.
Crux wishes to thank our advertising sponsor, Renew International, for their support of Crux and this episode of Last Week in the Church. Learn more about Renew International at renewintl.org.
All right, everybody, happy Tuesday to you. Happy Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. Before diving in this week, just a quick note to those of you who may be in the Chicago area. I will be amongst you later this week. This Thursday evening, I will be at the Union League Club in downtown Chicago. And Friday morning, I will be at the University of St. Mary of the Lake, Mundelein Seminary, speaking on Posterity Politics Protocol, the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI and the future of the Church. So again, that is the Union League Club Thursday night, University of St. Mary of the Lake Friday morning. If you're in the broader Chicago area and you could be with us, we would love to have you. Please drop by. All right, we begin this week with General Hospital. So once again, papal health has been front and center in the Vatican beat over the last week. We spoke last week about the Pope had reported a light cold without fever that had caused him to curtail his schedule a bit. That continued into this past week. There were certain engagements that the Pope canceled. Well, excuse me, sorry. Technically, a Pope never cancels anything. No Pope in the history of the Catholic Church technically has ever canceled an appointment. What he does instead is suspend them. And theoretically, that means, of course, they might be rescheduled at some future point. That comes with no guarantee, but in any event, that's the official vocabulary. So in some instances, the Pope suspended engagements on his official calendar. In others, he kept these appointments, but entrusted the reading of his prepared text to someone else. In the middle of all of this, after his customary Wednesday general audience, which takes place Wednesday morning Rome time every week, the Pope got in a car and scuttled cross town to Rome's Gemelli Hospital, where he underwent a series of what the Vatican described as diagnostic tests. Now, Italian media reported that these tests included a CAT scan. That has not been confirmed by the Vatican, but neither has anyone denied it. And frankly, it makes a lot of sense because obviously they wanted to rule out pneumonia as the cause of the Pope's respiratory difficulties. The way to do that is to do a CAT scan and get a sense of what's going on in the lungs. The Pope, on this jaunt to the Gemelli, was accompanied by his nurse, an Italian layman by the name of Massimiliano Strappetti, who in August 2022 was named by Pope Francis as his personal healthcare assistant. This is a brand new position in the Vatican. Pope Francis has created lots of new positions in the Vatican. This is one of them. In the past, the Pope had a personal physician, and he still does. But he never before has had a nurse that enjoys this relationship of trust. Pope Francis publicly credited Strapetti with being the guy who, quote, saved my life. In 2021, saying it was Strapetti who urged him to go to the Gemelli to have an operation on his colon, accurately diagnosing that there was a problem there that required surgical intervention. And the Pope quite clearly trusts Strapetti a great deal. Strapetti is a veteran, 55-year-old Italian healthcare professional. He cut his teeth working in the emergency room, Rome's Gemelli Hospital, so he obviously is accustomed to operating under pressure, then took a position in the Vatican working in the Vatican's own healthcare system. One thing we do know about Strapetti from his Facebook profile is that he's a big Lazio fan. There are two big professional soccer clubs here in Rome. One is Roma. That's my team. That's the team of the Allen household. It is the corporate team of Crux generally. And then there's Lazio, who are a hated Crux town rivals. So all I can say is that I hope Strapetti's medical judgment is far superior to his taste in soccer clubs. In any event. So the Pope went to the Gemelli, came back, continued to uphold his most of the appointments he had on his schedule. For instance, he had an appointment with German Chancellor Scholz on Saturday. He participated in a ceremony to open the Vatican's judicial year, although he entrusted the reading of his speech to someone else. On Sunday, from the window of the papal apartment, he delivered his normal noontime Angelus address in his own voice. And most of us who watched the performance thought the Pope seemed significantly better. His voice seemed strong. His energy level seemed good. And if you've been paying attention, this is, of course, a recurrent phenomenon with Pope Francis now. He will seem fine for a period of time. Then he will pick up some kind of bug. And particularly in these cold weather months here in Rome, it has been cold and rainy of late. And so no big surprise. And of course, at 87 years old, and with, you know, the miles on the tires that this Pope has, that will sometimes knock him down, not just for a few hours, but for a few days. He will have difficulty breathing. He'll have difficulty speaking in public. He'll get some rest, and then he will bounce back. We have seen it before. We saw it again this past week. Basic bottom line here, when it comes to these kinds of health scares, I will reiterate my basic rule of thumb. Don't listen to the most alarming comments, which typically will come from opponents of the Pope who were anxious for the papacy to be over. And also don't listen to the most reassuring comments from the Pope's official channels of communication and his most ardent supporters who don't even want to theoretically acknowledge that a day might come in which this papacy is going to end, who want it to be, who want him to be not just a holy father, but an eternal father. Okay? The truth always lies somewhere in the middle. So if you sort of aggregate all of these different messages, split the difference and divide it down the middle, that'll usually take you fairly close to the truth. All right, second up this week, we've got Double Deimos. So in March 2022, an anonymous letter purportedly written by a cardinal was circulated, published by a conservative Italian journalist, Sandro Magister, which contained a kind of indictment of the Francis papacy for allegedly promoting doctrinal confusion. It cited, for instance, the German synodal way, some comments by Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich on sexuality and marriage and other issues, basically arguing that confusion was reigning. The author of this document said that in the old days we used to say Roma locuta est, causa est finita, meaning Rome has spoken, the case is over. Today, he said, the motto is Rome has spoken and confusion is growing. Also went on to suggest that there were other flaws in this papacy, for instance, kind of antinomianism, that is, a disregard of the law, autocratic tendencies, vindictive tendencies in terms of punishing perceived opponents, such as traditionalists, advocates of the old Latin Mass, and so on. And in particular, This document, the original Demos, concentrated a lot on alleged failures in the Pope's Vatican reform campaign, especially when it came to finances. And that probably, at the time, for those of us who saw this when it originally came out, that was a pretty big tip-off as to who might have been behind this thing. Because half the indictment of the Francis papacy concerned his perceived failure of nerve to complete the financial cleanup operation he had begun. And it turned out, of course, that the author of that original document was Australian Cardinal George Pell, who had been appointed by the Pope to be the tip of the spear of that financial reform and then had his wings clipped. Of course, Pell has since gone to his reward. All right, so flash forward to this past week. Once again, a document purportedly written by a cardinal anonymously under the byline of Demos was issued, once again published on a conservative Italian Catholic site, in this case a site called La Nuova Bussola Quotidiana, meaning the New Daily Compass. And as opposed to the previous document, which was a kind of x-ray of the papacy as it stood at that point in March 2022, this document is more forward-looking. It is designed as a kind of checklist for the conclave that will have to elect Francis's successor. It contains 7 points, specifically, that it believes the next conclave will have to deal with. However, there is great overlap between the two documents because on this 7-point checklist, the most important ones would be, number one, counteracting what it describes as a climate of doctrinal confusion. This new document, Demos II, says that too often in this papacy, so-called compassion has been exalted over justice, truth, and clarity. It says that the next pope is going to have to stop acting autocratically, but instead see himself as the servant of a tradition, not its master, recognizing that the pope does not have the authority to set aside traditional Catholic teaching and practice, but he instead is the custodian of those traditions. It says the Pope is going to have to restore respect for the rule of law in the Vatican, arguing that Pope Francis too often has acted like, well, it doesn't use this language, but a kind of Latin American dictator issuing decrees, personal decrees in his own name that ride roughshod over the legal tradition of the state he supposedly is in charge of. And this checklist of items also suggests that the next pope is going to have to do a better job of promoting collegiality and, in particular, revitalizing the College of Cardinals, respecting the College of Cardinals, taking it seriously as the pope's most important sounding board. And, of course, that to-do list reflects perceived failures or deficiencies in this papacy. Now, what does all this add up to? Well, I'm not sure it changes the calculus much. I mean, frankly, we knew that the perceived autocratic tendencies of this papacy, its perceived vindictiveness, its perceived disrespect for church law, and above all, the idea that it's promoting doctrinal confusion, we already knew that those were the major axes to grind of the more conservative or traditional critics of this papacy. If anything, what this document does is it does us the service of laying all that out in a kind of concise, brief, cogent, and well-constructed formula. So, you know, when the time comes, when we want to know the case for discontinuity in the next conclave, that is the case for the opposition, you know, we will have a kind of handy-dandy reference. Now, should this be a subject of scandal? Should we be upset that if it is true that a cardinal is the one who produced this document, and of course a cardinal did produce the first Demos, we know that now, so no reason to doubt it, I suppose. Should we be, what, troubled, bothered, you know, sconvolto, as the Italians would say, upset about this? I don't know. I mean, you know, we are living in an era in which synodality, supposedly, is the defining virtue of the Catholic Church now, right? Synodality meaning participation, inclusiveness, and listening. We're supposed to be listening to all voices in the Catholic conversation. Is there anything on principle wrong with the idea of one of those voices coming along to say, hey, I think the next conclave is going to have some serious business to do? I would doubt that in principle there's anything wrong with that. The only issue here, I suppose, is the anonymity The author of this document claims that it has been published anonymously in order to avoid retribution, part of the alleged vindictiveness of this papacy. I think you can make an argument that if you're a cardinal of the Catholic Church, what's the worst that's going to happen? Okay? You know, I mean, and by the way, it's not like other cardinals have been hesitant about voicing issues they may have had with this papacy at various points. So, you know, we might wish that perhaps this could be done in the clear light of day. But other than that, if the top note of Catholic life these days is supposed to be an open, robust, no taboo discussion about the challenges facing the church, it is probably no bad thing that somebody in a position of leadership is contributing to that conversation. All right, third this week, the trouble with travel. So one of the items on this checklist of things the next pope, well, the next conclave, and therefore the next pope should deal with, has to do with papal travel. Deimos II says that while travel was a great thing for John Paul II because it suited his gifts and the temper of the times in which he led, the next pope probably ought to be more of a stay-at-home figure, arguing, number one, that the church in Italy and across Europe is in crisis, needs the pope's personal attention, and two, that reform of the Vatican is an urgent challenge. The pope is going to have to, like, take that in his own hands. The conclusion, therefore, is the next pope should travel less. Well, here is the thing. I think much of the rest of what Deimos II says, there is an argument that can be made both for and against. In other words, it falls into the category of a matter of opinion. I think on this one, however, just objectively and descriptively, it is difficult to believe this particular piece of advice is going to cut much ice when it comes to the next papacy, because the tides of history simply are shoving us in the opposite direction. Let me just make three quick points. One, both Benedict XVI and Francis came into office saying they were not going to travel as much as John Paul II. Benedict said, hey, that was John Paul's thing, it's not mine. Francis said, I didn't like travel when I was in Buenos Aires, I don't plan to do it now that I'm Pope. How many trips did John Paul make per year? Four. Over almost 27 years. How many trips did Benedict make over 8 years? Three a year. How many trips has Francis made per year over 11? Four a year. And that, by the way, was with a brief hiatus because of COVID. In other words, both Benedict and Francis ended up traveling basically just as much as John Paul II because they realized it has now become part of the basic job description of what it means to be Pope. The expectations of the Pope's physical presence are simply irresistible. Number two, if a pope were to decide in the future, I'm not going to travel, that would probably be perceived as the pope retreating from global leadership and engagement in global issues. In other words, it would betoken a weakened and diminished papacy, which would make it more difficult for the pope to do anything, including, by the way, revitalizing the fortunes of the Catholic Church in Italy and Europe. I mean, in other words, it would be counterproductive even to the state of reason for pulling back from hitting the road. Finally, I would suggest that the notion that the Pope's primary responsibility is to Italy or Europe is anyway a historical anachronism. We live in a time when 2/3 of the Catholic population lives outside the West. By the middle of this century, it will be 3/4. The Pope, whether you like it or not, is not an Italian or a European figure. He leads a global institution. He has global responsibilities. And one way of making that stick and getting it across is when he hits the road. So, for all of these reasons, my own diagnosis would be that while there is much else in the analysis of Deimos II that likely will be in play and up for grabs when the next papal election occurs, this one, my guess, not so much. All right. Fourth up this week, we've got jousting over gender. So one of the things that Pope Francis, despite his difficulties with bronchitis, one of the appointments he maintained this week was he dropped in to a conference on the anthropology of vocations. If you don't know what that means, don't worry, I don't really know either. But in any event, a conference on vocations in some broad sense, sponsored by a foundation launched by Canadian Cardinal Mark Ouellette, former head of the Vatican's Dicastery for Bishops and a longtime potentate on the Vatican scene. So Francis was scheduled to give a little fervorino, that is, a little greeting and encouragement to this conference. He had a prepared text which he had somebody else read, but in his own voice and extemporaneously, he decided that he wanted to throw in a few lines on what he described as the ugliest danger facing the church and the world today. Let me repeat that. The ugliest danger, what he described as the terrible ideology of gender theory. Now, if you have been paying attention to the Francis Papacy, you know that repeatedly, periodically, throughout the years, Francis has brought this idea of gender theory into his sights. It has always been somewhat difficult to define, but in broad strokes, it means the notion that sort of the denial of a biological difference between the sexes, that is, between men and women, the notion that sexual difference is a sort of cultural and social construct, it is malleable and a matter of personal choice, and more broadly, a denial that there are differences among people that are part of the natural order, and the idea that everything can sort of be leveled and made the same by the imposition of human will. Pope Francis has been a huge critic of gender theory, number one, because he sees it as a denial of biological reality, but also because he sees it as a form of ideological colonization, that is, a uniquely Western view of the meaning and purpose of human life that is being imposed on the rest of the world, particularly the developing world, down the barrel of a gun, either literally or figuratively through the use of compulsion having to do with financial aid and lending mechanisms and any number of other things. So he opposes it both substantively as a denial of biological reality and also procedurally as another chapter in the efforts of the West to ram its values and its perspective down the throat of the rest of the world. Now, if you haven't heard about this week, that is, if you're wondering, why wasn't this a big deal on, you know, the nightly news? Why wasn't it A1 on the New York Times? You know, why wasn't the BBC talking about this in Le Monde? You know, Süddeutsche Zeitung, and on and on. Well, I think the basic reason is because this is the classic instance of a storyline about Pope Francis that just doesn't fit the broader narrative. The broader narrative about this pope is that he is a progressive, right? He's a liberal, promoting kind of liberal reform of the Catholic Church, pro-LGBTQ, pro-women, pro-reform generally. And so the notion that he's out there attacking gender theory, that is taking on the secular and cultural left, just doesn't compute. I would add as a footnote that in addition to this broad sort of swipe at gender theory, the Pope once again also recommended the apocalyptic novel Lord of the World by Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson. This is a 1907 dystopian novel written by the son of an Archbishop of Canterbury, who, and therefore, because he was the son of the Archbishop of Canterbury, his conversion to Catholicism in 1903 was a sensation in Great Britain. In any event, this novel sort of discusses the rise of one world government under this messianic, Marxist, socialist, humanist Svengali, and it is, the ironic thing is, this text is a darling of the traditional and conservative wing of the Catholic Church and always has been. During the Cold War, it was one of the preferred texts of hardcore right-wing Catholic anti-communist hawks. And so the fact that Pope Francis is constantly running around praising this novel and taking on gender theory, again, from the point of view of the narrative about this pope, doesn't compute. And what does the media do? When we have a story that coheres with our narrative, we bang it like a cheap drum. When we have a story that challenges our narrative, we tend to ignore it because otherwise the cognitive dissonance is just too intense. So here is a classic instance in which the pope is defying his own narrative and, in my view, therefore makes this all the more interesting. All right, last up this week, we've got sizing up secularism. So among Western Catholics, that is, Catholics from Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, when we use the word secularism, generally speaking, we don't mean it positively, right? You know, when we say secularism, we're thinking I don't know, gay pride parades and priest shortages and, you know, watered-down witness to the Catholic faith and so on. To us, secularism is the boogeyman hiding under our beds, right? Just, however, under the heading of, you know, we're a universal church and not everything seems the same everywhere, let me point out that historically, that is over the last several decades, the greatest champions of secularism in the world have been the Catholic bishops of the Middle East. Why? Because for them, the choice is not between Christendom, that is a robust embrace of Christian faith and practice, or secularism. The choice is between secularism and annihilation at the hands of radical Islamic theocracy. And a similar dynamic is occurring in India right now, where over the last year there were 720 acts of physical violence directed at Christians. That's two, basically, every day. And where a rising tide of what's known as saffronization, that is the imposition of Hindu identity at the hands of the BJP party and related Hindu nationalist movements linked to Prime Minister Narendra Modi, are increasingly making life difficult for religious minorities, including Christians. The Indian bishops recently praised secularism. My point is, attitudes towards secularism reflect the complex realities of the global church. Whether you like secularism, whether you see it as a friend or foe, to a very great extent depends on your zip code, where you live, and the challenges you face. Another chapter, ladies and gentlemen, in navigating the global complexities of an increasingly worldwide and far-flung family of faith. All right, that is our show for this week. As ever, you can find full coverage of these stories on the Crux site, that is cruxnow.com. A reminder, if you're in Chicago, join me at the Union League Club Thursday night, University of St. Mary of the Lake Friday morning. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, have a fantastic and blessed week, and we will talk to you all again very, very soon.